You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
I was just explaining it, sir. I don't mind some sweater weather. I was just in Costa Rica for 15 days and it was 85 and sunny. Great for your circadian rhythm. Sun rises at 5:30, sets at 5:30 every single day.
Yeah.
It's great for scheduling.
Yeah.
You were traveling too. That's why we're here.
Yes, I did. I went to South Africa. Yeah.
And you visited Orania.
Yes, I did. And then briefly Pretoria as well.
You know, why did you want to go make this trip?
Yeah, I had some very specific reasons. So I think I told you about this, but earlier last year, I did a presentation in Belgium, and it had been 10 years that I did any kind of presentation. So, and it was a beautiful location, Bitcoin conference. So I wanted to make it something serious. So I did research into what's going on in Belgium, and I thought I was going to be talking about the banks and inflation and, you know, that kind of thing. But as I was digging into the data, I was more surprised to see that immigration has been really on the rise in Belgium. And, you know, I'm raised very progressively, you know, thinking like people assimilate and, you know, you teach them the language and, you know, life goes on. But one of the things that really shocked me to find was that not only are the immigration numbers like quite staggering, like right now, 37% of the Belgian population is of immigrant origin, meaning, you know, either you're first generation, second or third. And the thing that shocked me was to see how people vote, you know, it's really not that obvious that the civil liberties that I took for granted are going to be reflected in the voting patterns of the people that came and immigrated to your country, especially if they come from, you know, North Africa or Turkey and you know, from outside of Europe. And so really seeing that 80% of that cohort votes very, very left and even cast a Marxist vote, right? We have the Communist Party as the highest vote since 1948 right now in Belgium, over 10%. And so, yeah, it really was like a shock because I realized, well, this means it's possible that the whole country could change, you know, like the institutions, like everything. And also demographically that the people who used to be the natural majority, like the local population, they could become a minority. And so for a while I was like, man, I want to do something to help. There's, you know, I couldn't figure out what I could do. Like, and the best I could think of for quite a while was like, well, there's going to be a massive diaspora out of Western Europe, out of Belgium. Maybe I can help channel some of that. So maybe we can, I don't know, start like a colony in Argentina. And I was actually planning to, you know, go down there again and prospect and see what could be done. But then some friends showed me some things that were happening in South Africa, which is interesting because in a way it is kind of that scenario I just described. It's as if that already happened in South Africa. Of course, they have a very, you know, different history. They you know, the Afrikaners who landed there in the 1600s. If you look at the territory of South Africa, I think they've always been kind of a minority, demographically speaking. But ever since the early 90s, which was, you know, the end of apartheid, the Rainbow Coalition, all of a sudden everybody who lived there had a vote. And then the kind of European descendants, they became, I think, 20. And then now it's probably more like 10% of the population. So you're in a situation where it's just impossible to ever vote your way to a different system or a different way of doing things, and where ideologies like Marxism just go rampant. You have very blatant parties that totally align themselves with that kind of thinking. But nonetheless, they've been able to build things there that are really impressive. And so the first thing that caught my eye was Oranje, which is an Afrikaner-only town. It was started in the early 90s by just like 13 people in the middle of nowhere. It's called the Karoo, which is very, very arid land, very, very difficult to do anything with. If you're close to the river, you can do some irrigation. You can actually get some decent crops, but only through irrigation. Other than that, you can raise some cattle. You know, think like Patagonia, or think, you know, West Texas, like that kind of climate. And so, yeah, they just struck out there in the middle of nowhere with just very few people. And they've managed over the period of 40 years now to grow it into a town of 3,000 people. And it's just super interesting to see how they work. And I was intrigued. So I went down there. I spent 8 days in the town. I talked to a lot of people, you know, some of the founders, the CEO of the Oranje movement, spent a lot of time with him. And then also the entrepreneurs that are building, because one of the challenges as well is that when you have a failing state is that all the services that we take for granted, you know, sewage, security, electricity, obviously schooling, media, you know, all those things, they all just decay more and more and more. And one thing I did learn is that when we in the West, when we think about collapse, we like to think of it as like some kind of meteorite type event, like a big thing. And then, oh yeah, now we're living in the collapse. But the reality is more that no, you wake up, and today is going to be 0.01% worse than the day before. And it's just this kind of gradual grinding. So what's happened in South Africa is that because of the copper theft, a lot of that's only one reason, and also just general mismanagement. But there's so many brownouts. Like there's not a reliable electricity network anymore. And so what they've done in Oranje is gradually build up more capacity. Because one thing they do have is sun. And so right now, I believe 50% of the money that the inhabitants spend on electricity goes to the local producers, like so solar panels, either on your own roof of your own house. And there is one company, Orasol, who has a big production capacity. They also have a giant battery that they bought. And so they basically can iron out almost all the brownouts by now. So yeah, you know, there's a lot more to say, but it was really special to be there.
Yeah. The reason I saw you tweeting about it, and I DM'd you immediately, because this idea of free cities, free states, whatever it may be, a municipality that decides that it wants to sort of separate from a federal government, whatever it may be, and just sort of inoculate itself from everything and run a private society, something that's been talked about quite a bit. I mean, what's his name? Begins with an R. He's been on Rakim.
I'm not familiar.
Yeah, he's, I think he's with the Students for Liberty.
And there's a lot of words nowadays. There's free cities, there's charter cities, yes, there's Bitcoin citadels. People think about declaring independence. Like that's another idea. Maybe like we'll buy an island and things like that. Yeah, there's a lot of it.
There's this whole concept of just distilling it to individuals getting together and saying, we think us as a free market can produce the goods and services that the state typically provides and provide for ourselves. And it seems like Oranje is doing it.
Yeah. And the super cool thing about South Africa is that there wasn't some kind of, you know, civil war where all of a sudden this, you know, ethnic group, they won and they were able to carve out this, you know, giant space for themselves. They just basically started doing it. And one of their mantras is man, maximum achievable non-compliance. And also state proofing is something they talk a lot about, which is basically you try and organize yourself in such a way that the government has a hard time messing it up because you're just less and less reliant on government services.
Yeah, the Amish are a great example of that here.
You know, what is?
The Amish.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they're very state-proof. Absolutely. Right. Yeah, and so one of the things I think I'm learning is that if you're libertarian inclined, it's tempting to really boil it down to the individual and think like, all right, I'm going to sit on my ranch and I do my thing and I'm going to be, you know, I have solar and everything, be totally independent. But, you know, once you start talking about crime, for example, it's not that obvious to just be on your lonesome. It's actually rather impossible. Like in South Africa, for example, not that the government is actively going out and murdering farmers, but there's such a lawlessness and there's such a kind of a almost like permissive culture when it comes to that. Like the criminals basically don't go to jail. So every week a farmer gets murdered and tortured. And
a boer, right?
Sorry?
A boer?
Yeah, the boer is the name. That's the original name for, it meant farmer originally, but now the boer are more like a people. Yeah, they're the ones who are mostly descended from people who landed in the 1600s, and then there were those are mostly Dutch, and then later you had Huguenots from France and Portugal, I believe, and then, you know, blending together, they're called the Boer or the Afrikaner. Yeah,
and these criminals have pretty sophisticated technology that they're using. They're using like
signal
jackers, and
yeah,
they know what they're doing. They go in with those Wi-Fi jackers with the antennas and blackouts.
Well, and they also have the advantage of numbers, right? If you have a gang of five and you're going to attack, you know, a farmer who's there with his wife and kids, you have a lot of it. And then also you choose the time of attack. Like, he doesn't know when you're coming. So one of the other things that they start doing in South Africa is on a, like, almost like nationwide, they have this organization that I visited. It's called AfriForum, and they really try and meet the Afrikaners where they're at in terms of the needs. And so they start organizing neighborhood watches, for example. They have 170 of them, and they use a lot of modern technology, even drones and things like that, to monitor. And then they have a control center where all the information comes in. And so they're able to send private security to those places and help out. So there's a pretty amazing collaboration between the nonprofit, which is AfriForum. They have like 215,000 paying members, and then the for-profit, which are more the private security companies that are on the ground providing services. And they even have a kind of a VC role in that sense, where they, you know, if there's a need in a certain community for more security, they may like invest in a startup private security firm, have some equity in that firm, and then their incentives are aligned to grow together. You know, not that it's a big source of profit, but it does make it so that incentives are more aligned and resources can be allocated. I mean, all of this blew my mind. I was like, wow, like, you know, we're so used to the government being performant, and we have been for, especially I think in the US, in Europe, the decline has happened more quickly, and things were more brittle already 10, 20 years ago. But yeah, you can see how fast things go awry once the government is just like overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that has to do with the justice system, right? Once you get a two-tier justice system where,
property,
I don't know, they want to prosecute speech crimes because they're afraid to lose power, and then they make it so that carjackers only get a one-year sentence, and then they get to walk free. Well, then that means the most hard criminals, they roam free. I mean, even if that's only 1% of the population, it's an absolute menace for everybody else.
Yeah, it's an asymmetric, intolerant minority in the wrong reasons.
Yeah, yeah.
And so did you, I mean, you talked to a bunch of people over the 8 days that you were there. How did Orania evolve to the point that it is today? Obviously, they started in the early 90s. It's been a slog. I don't know if it's a slog, but they've been iterating and building and expanding for 40 years.
Yeah, so one of the names who's most often associated with the apartheid regime is Vervoort. He was, I believe, prime minister. He actually was born in the Netherlands, and he was a statesman for a long time. And he had a vision to develop South Africa economically. And one of the ideas he had was that along the Orange River, there was going to be lots of they were going to make the flow a lot more predictable because water is very scarce in that country. And so if you build dams, in a very calculated way, then you create a lot more opportunity for irrigation and cities to grow along that river. So that was his plan. And they already started with some projects. And so along one of the dams, there was the beginning of a development, which is basically just some housing for the workers who had been building the dam. And that was completely abandoned. Nobody was living there. But, you know, there were some road-type structures. And also because of the dam, the flow of the river becomes very predictable, which is great for irrigation. And so then they identified that as the startup group as a good place to maybe buy some land, and by some fluke they were able to buy it. It was actually not obvious at all that they were going to get it, but then they did. They were able to buy it quite cheap at the time, and then with I believe just 13 people they started building, and one of the first things they did was build, and you can still see it, like a pipeline of water through the city, which would then provide the houses with, you know, basic sanitation and things like that. I don't even know when they start purifying the water. Right now it's incredibly potable. You can just drink all the water. It's very, very fresh. They have two water systems. So one is just directly from the river for irrigation and those kind of things. And then the other is more expensive, is the purified kind. But so yeah, they told me that the actual pipeline was welded together by a couple of 15 and 16 year olds, you know, who had picked up the skills and were able to do that over time. And they had to remove so many rocks just to make the plots viable to put a house down. I saw the boulders. They're just enormous boulders that you have to pull out of the ground before you can dig the foundations for any kind of building. So it must have been incredible, like the amount of work that they did. It's just very, very salt of the earth type work. And one of the things that makes Oranje unique is that they only use their own labor. And so they don't go around and get cheap labor from around the country. They really, only the people that actually are residents there do the work. And so I think that's also why they had a slow start. But it was very deliberate because they realized that if you pull in a lot of that labor, well, then those people are going to live around where you live. And if they have a different culture, well, they're just going to keep voting along, you know, along the lines of their own culture, which is understandable. But so that can jeopardize the kind of cultural project and or the vision that you have for your, you know, your town or your city. And so that's one of the things that really sets Oranje apart from other towns in South Africa or around the world, really, where... the two restrictions are restriction of labor and residency. So it's only open for people who are Afrikaners and Protestant Christians. And so basically, if you're like an Italian Catholic, like you're not going to get residency there. You're allowed to visit. Like, it's very open. There's a big road riding through town. One of the debates that they've been having is like, huh, should we make that a toll road? Like, should we have like a toll booth there? Because we kind of work to maintain the road and things like that. You're free to just, anyone can just go on vacation there. And it's very, very hospitable. There's lots of little hotels they call it Gasthuis, guest houses, and restaurants, all those kind of things.
What's up, freaks? This is Nat. You don't want to skip because Fold has a great offer for you. Everyone knows about Fold, the app where you can earn the most Bitcoin rewards for everyday purchases. I did this yesterday. Me and my wife, we use Amazon to buy quite a few things. And instead of just putting our credit card into Amazon and buying there, I put my credit card into Fold. and buy an Amazon gift card and upload it to Amazon. Why? Because I get the credit card points and then I get sats back. Yesterday I bought a gift card. I made 10,181 sats, about $10.50 in Bitcoin. And it's the only way to do it. If you want to stack Bitcoin passively, make sure you're using Fold gift cards. Fold has a special deal. I mentioned it earlier. If you're not shopping with Fold gift cards, you're leaving sats on the table. New users that sign up to Fold are going to get 20,000 sats in a welcome bonus with their first gift card purchase. So don't leave sats on the table. Sign up now at foldapp.com/Marty. Get those 20,000 sats, freaks. Sup, freaks. This rip of TFTC was brought to you by our good friends at BitKey. BitKey makes Bitcoin easy to use and hard to lose. It is a hardware wallet that natively embeds into a 2 or 3 multi-sig. You have one key on the hardware wallet, one key on your mobile device, and Block stores a key in the cloud for you. This is an incredible hardware device for your friends and family, or maybe yourself who have Bitcoin on exchanges and have for a long time, but haven't taken the step to self-custody because they're worried about the complications of setting up a private public key pair, securing that seed phrase, setting up a PIN, setting up a passphrase. Again, BitKey makes it easy to use, hard to lose. It's the easiest 0-to-1 step, your first step to self-custody. If you have friends and family on the exchanges who haven't moved it off, tell them to pick up a BitKey. Go to bitkey.world, use the key TFTC20 at checkout for 20% off your order. That's bitkey.world, code TFTC20.
And when it comes to the private services, how did they come to evolve? Like, you said the town's only 3,000 people.
Yeah.
Right. So how, like, did they want to grow the population more? Are they happy with the
size
of the
town? They grow by 15% a year, 15% a year. Yeah. Really? And the growth is restricted mainly by their ability to build more houses. Right. So so there's a lot of builders who live in the town. Some of them will only live there for 1 or 2 years. A lot of them will stay longer. There's programs to help people buy. Like, it's like a almost interest-free loans where you get to, they structured it so that you basically only pay the equivalent of what you would pay for rent anyway, a little bit more. And then over the course of, I think, 5 years, you've financed your own house. Because you've also helped build, you know, with your own hands, you've helped build it, and it's a relatively small plot. And so, but people get enormously motivated by the idea of, you know, if you're a young family, you can actually own your own home. It's very motivating, and especially in a safe town, because that is really a perk. It's an incredible, I mean, a perk is a bit too pejorative. What do you call it? It's an incredible feature of that community that it's so safe that kids and, you know, little girls and whoever can just run around free no matter what time of day. It is just really safe. And that's very rare in South Africa.
What were the conversations with the citizens like?
Well, there were all kinds of people. I'm trying to see. Some people had lived there for 20 years. Other people just arrived like a year ago. Some people were scoping it out still. I talked to several Afrikaners who actually, they had been on vacation for a few times to Oranje, and they were really starting to think about, okay, I think we want to come and live here. And then they were always thinking in terms of their business. Like, you know, one guy I talked to, he still had a trucking company, and he had to be in other parts of the country. And so he was thinking you know, passing it on to somebody else, starting a new line of business. His wife was very good with textile and embroidery and things like that. So she was thinking about starting a business in town for that. I spoke to a company that produced jewelry because they thought about the general challenge of the town is, you know, you're in kind of in the middle of the desert. So how do you generate economic output, right? How do you make sure that there is more money going, like, being accumulated than you have to invest? And so these people figured that a jewelry business could be a great thing to do because the cost to import the raw materials is relatively low. There's not a lot of weight, so you can transport it for a long way to get there. And then they add a lot of value, and they can sell online, and it can be sold anywhere. So that business is doing really well. Apparently, because society is so brittle there and so volatile, people don't assume that if you have a business that you're going to be operating it for 10 years. So very often you'll have a business for 2 years and then your market just disappears and you have to find another market, or you know, you have three activities at the same time so that if one diminishes, you can focus more on the other ones. Because there's also the problem of, you could call it reverse racism, where there's a lot of quotas from the government to hire non-whites. Even if you're an Afrikaner and you have a business, in certain instances you can be forced to hire a certain amount of black people. And then I think also because of the general atmosphere that there is a kind of an actual racism against the idea of, you know, hiring Afrikaners who are European looking. And so, yeah, many people I talked to, they said it's hard to find jobs. So that's why also they had a lot of, over the years, the last 30 years, a lot of people moved abroad to, you know, Canada. There's even a whole bunch of Afrikaners here in Texas working on ranches because they're very good at, you know, running a farm. And they're very reliable, and so they find work here, for example.
Yeah. Mm. It is correct, because I've seen a lot of posts on Twitter and other social platforms about the devolution of South Africa.
Yeah.
Talk to some South Africans, and it's hard to discern what, like, how bad the situation is.
It's really bad.
Is it bad?
Yeah, I mean, what I've heard is that if you have a good job, you can stick by certain rules. And if you stick by the rules, you'll be okay. Like, although everybody knows, everybody has been mugged or has been, you know, a victim of some kind of crime and may know people that have been, you know, that have been hurt or even killed, you know, it's still, you know, because they have high trust among themselves, there's a lot you can do to stay safe. But it's kind of like if you don't live in Oranje and you live in Pretoria, for example, or another city, you go from, you know, your vehicle to your house, which has a big fence around it, to another place that has, you know, barbed wire around it. So there's walls everywhere. And that was something somebody told me, is that in general, in society, you always need walls. The question is just where are you going to build them, right? And so with Oranje, they're like, well, we're going to have a kind of a perimeter around the town because they have a security firm with 10 people working in it full time. And they patrol the area and they keep people safe. Or you don't have that and there's just lawlessness and then you have to build walls everywhere, you know, from maybe you need even an armored vehicle or things like that eventually.
Yeah. Do they have individual gun rights in Oranje?
Individual
gun rights?
So they just abide by all the laws of South Africa, and it's another one that is like makes you roll your eyes because obviously the gangs have the craziest guns and other weapons, but the laws are very strict in South Africa, and so it takes you 9 months to get a license to even I think you can carry it, but basically get a license to own a gun, like a 9mm. And then there's also these laws that if you shoot someone who entered your home and he's not a direct threat to your life, well, then you can be prosecuted and get in trouble. It's tough in that sense. And that's also why this organization, AfriForum, they also have a branch where they have a judicial focus. They really actively sue politicians or government institutions, or really try to push back to these crazy, counterproductive, destructive regulations, really. So yeah, that also actually gave me hope, because that was one of the things that I was like, crime is just going rampant in Belgium, and you know, people are not allowed to, you know, but there's always something that is allowed, and you can kind of start with that and then push back. Private security firms, you know, they have people from ex-military and they are better trained. So you kind of work with what you have, you know.
This rip was brought to you by our great friends at Unchained. As Bitcoin's role in the global financial landscape evolves, understanding its potential impact on your wealth becomes increasingly crucial. Whether we see measured adoption or accelerated hyper-Bitcoinization, being prepared for various scenarios can make the difference between merely participating and truly optimizing your position. This is important, freaks. This is why Unchained developed the Bitcoin Calculator, a sophisticated modeling tool that helps you visualize and prepare for multiple Bitcoin futures. Beyond traditional retirement planning, it offers deep insights into how different adoption scenarios could transform your wealth trajectory. What sets this tool apart is the integration with the Unchained IRA, the only solution that combines the tax advantages of a retirement account with the security of self-custody. In any future state, maintaining direct control of your keys remains fundamental to your Bitcoin strategy. Go explore the potential futures at unchained.com/TFTC. Bitcoin is going up. Make sure you're protecting it the right way. Make sure you have a good partner. That is Unchained. Go to unchained.com/TFTC.
What is the perception of Orania within the rest of South Africa or parts of it?
Apparently, early on, it was extremely negative. And ironically, it wasn't so much, you know, the black majority of the population who was, you know, who hated it, because they didn't really care about it. It was so small. But it was mainly, apparently, what you could call their version of the neocons, you know, the pro-apartheid people who had been part of this big bureaucracy that had been built up, this powerful state, and who wanted to stay in power. And then, because basically if you start building Orania, you're saying like, look, we think these cities are lost. We're going to build this little thing. We're going to try and save this one person in the sick bay. And we're letting these big institutions and cities just, we're not going to try and resuscitate them. And I think that's why a lot of anger came, because it's kind of, in their mind, it was admitting defeat. And then gradually that changed. And now I believe they did some poll. 80% of the Afrikaners are very positive about it. You know, it doesn't mean they'll live there, but they're supportive.
Yeah. And having spent time there and talked to a lot of people, do you think this model is socially scalable? Right now, a town of around 3,000 growing at 10% a year. You think it reaches scaling limits at any point?
Yeah, I mean, they're thinking about that a lot, because they don't want to, you know, ruin what they have. They don't want to grow too fast. I think it's absolutely scalable, because you have that cultural homogeny. Is that the word, homogeny?
Yeah.
And so it just, historically, it's been scalable. I mean, we've had cities around Europe where people had a similar culture, and they just scaled it. And they, you know, I grew up in a city with literal moats and big gates, you know, like Bruges, where I grew up, is that's I think how people learned to work through the Middle Ages, because really the Middle Ages was a period where you didn't have the Roman legions to, you know, keep the Vandals at bay and all the roving gangs and all that. And so there was lawlessness in Europe. And the way to counter that was to kind of start small and gradually build out your communities. I don't think they're doing anything new. I think if anything, they're just reviving an old model that we had kind of forgotten in a time where we thought, you know, or a lot of people thought, it's the end of history, you know. Everybody's a liberal democracy now. There's abundance. We can always print more money if we need to. Anyone can get welfare. Anyone can live together always. So we're fine. And I think that idea is, or that illusion is collapsing now. And so I think in a way we're going back to reality. So yeah, I think it's, I don't see another model, to be honest, really. If you're thinking about how do you restore order? Like, you can't control other people. Like, you can't control, I don't know, like in South Africa, it's probably like 90 million people there now, because it was the wealthiest country. Even, you know, after the 90s, there was a lot of wealth remaining in the country, and it was by far the wealthiest country in all of Africa. And so they had so much inbound migration that, what are you going to do? Like, control 90 million people? No, but you can you can choose who you work with. It's like, it's the voluntarist idea.
Yeah, this seems like the pun intended, a cultural shift is underway globally.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just look at what Trump signed over the last 3 days, first 3 days, not day three now, but I mean, a lot of the executive orders, like the one he signed yesterday, essentially gutted affirmative action as put forth by Lyndon B. Johnson in the 60s, DEI ripped out of government.
So yeah, what is the essence of affirmative action?
You have to hire, among race.
It's like there's quotas, basically?
There's quotas, yeah.
Really? And that was in place ever since LBJ?
I think so, I believe, yes.
Wow, that's what I didn't know that. It's funny, right? Because diversity has been such a buzzword, but if you really think about it, what is the opposite of diversity? It's consensus, I would say. It's like when you agree, there is a consensus, and when opinions diverge, you have diversity. So in a way, like, maybe we've been enshrining conflict more than anything else.
Yeah. I mean, we're seeing in the UK, you can't even talk about wanting to preserve British culture.
Yeah.
All throughout Europe, you're seeing all these right-leaning political parties begin to...
Yeah, we call them right-leaning from here, but over there, they're labeled extreme right or far right. Yeah.
It's a tough conversation for many people to have, because I'm 33. That's been my whole life, is this idea of diversity, multiculturalism. Yeah. The melting pot makes us stronger. And
yeah, and I mean, so one of the things I've been realizing myself is that it's easy to be progressive if you're not in the midst of the actual diversity exploding around you. Like, I grew up very sheltered. I traveled a lot. Like, my parents took me traveling all around Europe, and even some Morocco and Turkey and places like that. But Bruges was extremely homogenous as far as its own population. And so it's very easy, you know, to live in that kind of, you know, how I think that the criticism here in the US is like, oh, you know, the liberal politicians, they live on Martha's Vineyard and they get to hang out with their you know, like-minded friends at the country club, but they don't realize what it's like to all of a sudden have every year one percentage of the population gets added, and they're from completely different cultures. You know, and so I've kind of become a little less naive as to what it actually does.
Yeah.
Especially because it's often imposed. Like, people don't vote for it. They don't vote for, like, oh yeah, let's, you know, where do we want to import people from? It's like, oh yeah, let's vote in this country. And no, it's imposed, and it's often an attack on democracy as well, because it's the socialist parties who want more votes, and they know that they're going to get their loyalty from the people that they give welfare to. And so in a way, they're importing just votes. It's really quite awful if you think about it. Like, respect. Like, they talk a big deal about respecting everybody and respecting other cultures, but when it comes down to it, it's just, they're importing cattle. In their mind, it's just going to be cattle that votes the way they want to.
Yeah. Turn Texas purple, and then we're going to turn it blue.
Yeah.
No, and I mean, I experienced this. I grew up in Northeast Philadelphia, and for the first 10 years of my life, and it's where my parents grew up, met. They went to the same preschool together. And historically, the neighborhood I grew up in was blue-collar, Irish, Italian, Catholics, and by the time we left, the neighborhood had completely changed. And
really?
If I go back to Philly now and drive by the church that we used to go to Mass, it's even said in English anymore. It's in Portuguese and in Vietnamese. And that happened in one generation. I mean, my parents had a pretty homogenous upbringing, but by the time me and my brother were born, within 10 years, the neighborhood had completely changed.
And I don't know if it's the same for you, but when I go back to Belgium, it really is painful to see the breakdown of trust. You know, like, for example, you go to the supermarket, you know, you buy your groceries, and then you can't just leave. There's actually a gate, and you have to scan your ticket, and then the gate has to open before you can exit. It's because they have so much theft. You know, it didn't used to be like that. Like, churches used to be open. You used to be able, any day of the week, you just walk into a church and, like, you know, sit down and have a quiet moment. That's gone. Like, none of the churches are open anymore. So there's a huge price that comes with this uncertainty, because that's really what it is. Like, everybody operates on a completely different cultural operating system. It's not about skin color at all. It's really about what people's innate cultural programming is. And I think probably a combination of the media and academia and schooling, and it probably was with good intentions, but I think we've been sheltered to an extreme as to what the negative consequences are of having mixing together dozens of cultures just like that.
Diametrically opposed cultures.
Right. And it's also like you used to be able to go to Paris and be like, oh, I go to Paris because I get a certain experience. I go to a town in Switzerland, I get another experience. And now more and more, you kind of get a similar experience because everything is mixed. You know, and maybe that's a petty thing to be like, oh, well, I want my vacation to be, you know, culturally homogenous. But imagine living there. It's like, you know, you lived in a certain culture, and then all of a sudden it's kind of a jungle. Like, for example, in the circle around Brussels, I thought this was an interesting metric. I've mentioned it a few times already. So Brussels, obviously a city, it's like 1.5 million people, something like that, or 1 million, kind of like Austin in a way. So then there's the ring, the ring around Brussels, which is totally rural, just, you know, small towns around Brussels. So 10 years ago already, 75 languages were being spoken in that ring. And recently they did an update, and now it's 104 languages in those rural towns. Like, that's like the Tower of Babel.
Yeah.
Like, that is just literally the biblical nightmare. How do you get anything done?
Right. I can go back to, like, diversity is the opposite of consensus. Like, how can you reach consensus?
Well, yeah. And then you could say, if you're very cynical, you're like, whoa, that's just Bezmenov's cycle. And this is the stage of demoralizing. Like, you just kind of try to create maximum demoralization so that then the next stage you can be like, all right, the central government is going to come in. We're going to plan everything for everyone. You know, we're the religion now. You can worship us. You know, we're going to impose the homogenic culture, and it's going to be extremely sterilized and depressing.
Yeah.
I don't think it's conscious, but it's sad, because that's potentially the direction it goes. I think Europe, the danger is really that it becomes Maoistic, you know, that kind of culture.
I mean, it seems like it could easily go that way if things don't change fast. And you have, I'm not sure if you've been watching clips from the World Economic Forum, but I caught a couple this morning. And it seems like the people who run the World Economic Forum have been pushing a lot of the policies that have led to the results that we've been discussing seem a bit worried, particularly with Trump getting elected.
And oh, yeah, yeah, I saw it. Like, they're getting, I'm glad they're finally getting worried. A friend of mine actually just yesterday pointed out, like, he's like, oh, it's no coincidence George Soros named his foundation the way he did. And I was like, what? Oh, open society.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, yeah, it's so interesting to live in this particular epoch. It's so much is changing.
So much is obviously with the Trump admin coming in, and it seems like we're making a very stark shift here in the United States. And I think there is an overt recognition of the problems that have arisen from unfettered immigration, illegal immigration predominantly over the last 4 years. And there is a reaction to that. And I'm highly encouraged that the U.S. leading the charge against this sort of imposition on American values, American culture, hopefully it can be a signal to the rest of the world, like, get your shit together.
Well, that's one of the things that's not, it's not that clear to me, and I'm not trying to be a Debbie Downer, but I do agree. Some people told me in South Africa that Trump being elected, on the one hand, it's great for them because they actually now, they know a bunch of people in the administration. It's a lot easier for them to, you know, maybe get some support or something like that. But on the other hand, it may lull Americans into this illusion that big government is there to fix it for them, and you can just kind of vote your way to freedom rather than really get your hands dirty and build institutions, you know, because you and I can, to a large extent, probably agree on, like, oh, this is American culture. But, you know, if we put all the American residents together, or we do a poll, I think the answers would vary a lot as to what is essentially American. I think that's become more clear that there's these rifts, you know, and so hopefully it can stay a structured enough umbrella to hold a lot of different cultures that can then maybe each do their own thing. I'm not sure, but yeah, I don't think, because I think the in a way, technology is amazing, but it also has caused this global confusion. And I'm thinking about just transportation, you know, airplanes, cars. I heard someone say that, you know, the apartheid regime, or whatever, the regime that was there before in South Africa, they worked so hard at building out all the roads, the road infrastructure, and inadvertently they actually caused 30 million more people to just flood into the country because it's so easy to drive everywhere. And I think that's really also something that we didn't expect, that to come together with the technological revolution, right? How cheap it is to travel.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that, because I was in a couple of cities in Costa Rica, and the roads are terrible over there. And you talk to some of the people on the ground, they're like, no, we want to keep the roads terrible. It's harder to get to. We don't want to spoil
interesting, this
incredible
right?
piece of paradise that we have.
That's very interesting. Yeah. And so we can be like this techno optimism. It can really have a lot of unintended consequences, which I'm still waking up to. But yeah, and I think that it's kind of like, there's this comparison probably with Bitcoin and cyberspace, where all the information wants to be free. And in cyberspace, everything flows so easily. And that makes it all the more important to have cryptography, so that you have some domains that there's some boundaries, and that you guard them really closely, because otherwise you just get gray goo and it's all over. You can't preserve value if you can't preserve boundaries.
Yeah, you need the ability to protect what you want to protect in the digital world, and filter, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, we need good filtering mechanisms for
right
the information that we receive, distill, and try to make decisions based off of. And I mean, bringing this back to the Trump admin in America, and I completely agree with you. I think the potential for people to get lulled into this false sense of security that the MAGA Republicans in charge are going to fix the country is real. And my hope is that the administration, if it accomplishes anything, would be that it just provides cover for people to get shit done engender that Iranian sort of ethos of, no, we're going to fix this ourselves.
Yeah. One of the things they really think a lot about or try to embody is they want to build before the storm. They want to kind of be prepared for when the storm comes. And I still think there is so much, if you just think in purely economic terms, I don't know. I don't know if, you know, all the banks and all the local governments and all the large governments are going to be able to balance their budgets the next couple decades. I really don't think so. And then all the people, like, all their savings are so depleted. So I really think that, things are going to, there's going to be a breakdown in certain ways. And you see that too, where like in Europe, for example, once it does start breaking down, it feeds upon itself. Like the copper thefts, you know, all of a sudden, a lot of regular businesses can't do business as usual anymore. Their cost of operating like jumps up because of the damage done by crime and et cetera. So it feeds upon itself. So I don't know if we'll be able to stave off a depression. Maybe the technology, it's like, oh, well, you know, AI and robotics, and maybe, you know, that we'll be able to do some of that. But anyway, like, I think it's good that we're getting a bit more time to build. And I don't think you only want to build defensively, like you want to build something positive. But also there is a level of scale that you want to achieve so that you're robust enough as a community to withstand whatever calamities are there. And, you know, buying a little apartment in Dubai, I don't know, you know, it feels like that seems to be the easy exit now for people that have done well in Bitcoin or crypto. It's like, oh yeah, I'm going to just, you know, go to a sunny location and hang out by the pool. I mean, that's fine, but it's not going to save the West. You know, it's not going to help transport these values that have been developed over centuries into the future for the next generations.
Yeah. Mm. Well, I guess that gets to the question, like, what do you think if we are being provided cover under this administration for 4 years, people should be focusing on to prepare for a potential storm? Because it's coming. I mean, I think Bitcoin.
But yeah, what do you think about storm wise?
Community. I mean, that's part.
But you think the storm is still coming?
Yeah. There's
I don't know.
There's way too much sovereign debt.
Maybe
there's,
Bitcoin bonds are going to fix the debt or something.
Yeah, I mean, they could certainly help. I think that is a low-hanging fruit step in the right direction. It's been incredible to see the legislation at the state level over the last few weeks. I believe now we're up to 13 states that have presented legislation about a state-level Bitcoin strategic reserve, I think. But I really think people need... harder to do is really bunker down and create a tight-knit community of family, extended family, and like-minded individuals who care about growing the nuclear family. I think it all comes back to that. And I mean, that's part of the reason, I mean, we're moving back to the Philadelphia area to be close with our family at some point later this year. And I think that part of that decision is, one, we miss our family, and two, like this calling to go back and and to support our family and build out community there. Community is actually very, very good in Philadelphia. Get integrated with the community there and hopefully support it and help strengthen it.
Right.
But yeah, I think individuals at the individual basis, like everybody should be saving in Bitcoin, be saving in dollars.
Yeah, it gives you optionality. Yeah, and I do think it's starting to crystallize more in my mind that just the basic services of the state, you know, that there are all these parallel systems that can be developed to mitigate the breaking down of those, like electricity is obvious here in Texas with solar, for example. Internet you can get from the sky nowadays, maybe in other ways as well. I mean, I know people are working on mesh networks and stuff like that, but yeah, the redundancy I think is important. Also, you know, in a way the food system has been polluted, so that's in a way that also you could attribute that to state failure. So having your own ways to produce food or acquire food. Yeah, and then security, I think, is also an obvious one and a big one. It's a little easier in Texas because of the gun laws. But probably, you know, around the Western world, it's going to be a huge conversation, you know, and of course, startups are going to emerge and all kinds of technologies are going to help. But I do think these are things to focus on. It's like, you know, it doesn't mean the answers are obvious, but I do think if you focus on them consistently, answers will emerge. Because, yeah, it is true that we can be like, oh, Bitcoin bonds, they're going to save the government. But that's only if Bitcoin does what we think it does. And that means 90% of people, they're not going to have any Bitcoin exposure. Their bond portfolio, their real estate portfolio is going to not help them. So, yeah, that is, I think in general, unemployment is baked into the cake because of the low interest rates. The whole economy has been skewed for decades, right? It's like Google should never have become as big as it is, or Facebook or the social media companies, or, you know, it should have been more the agriculture producers, the mining companies, the basic technology, the foundation of the economy has been underfunded, brutally underfunded for a long time, at the expense of all the service industries. So yeah, I mean, that's going to be fixed. And in that adjustment period, we need robust. I mean, I think it's going to be good. It's like when you're ill, you know, like when you're ill is like when you focus on the basics. It's like, okay, I got to get rest. I got to go on a walk. I got to, you know, look at my diet. So I think in a way it'll be very healthy to go through this kind of fasting, collective fasting period.
Yeah. Mm. Do you think depression is on the table?
Like economically?
Yeah.
Yeah, probably both, you know, Trump derangement, depression. And I do think so. I think it's, isn't it kind of already here? Like all these people that are like, they're stunned. They're like, hey, but I am doing all the things I'm supposed to do. I have a job. I have a little side job. And I can't pay the bills. Like, isn't that kind of the definition of a depression? I don't know. Maybe it's just the beginning. I really... It's weird, right? Because it's not going to be that for everybody, but for a certain cohort of people, yeah, things are going to be tough economically. And in a way, because everybody has to change into the new paradigm. It's only once we all change into the new paradigm that we can have a new era of prosperity. But if you're behind, well, I mean, that's also where institutions can do the work, right? If you build parallel institutions and then you have, you see that in Oranje a lot, like they're building facilities for, you know, old people. They're helping out the newly arrived that don't have any money to try and get a house for them and these very basic things. So in a way, I think that's also, you know, if you're doing well, it's a way to get more people on board with like, hey, like the world is changing. You can't just, does that make sense? Like you can't just have no rules.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of where we're coming from is like ever since, I don't know, the 60s, 70s, like it's been this kind of hedonic idea of like, oh, we can just do anything. There's no rules and there's no consequences. Well, then if all the subsidies evaporate, well, then the people who are left that do have some money, they're going to be like, well, yeah, we can help you out, but there's going to be some rules.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Now it is a massive problem to try to wrap your head around. I'm not sure if you've seen Sam Hyde's recent monologues that he's given.
No.
But it touches on a lot of this, and it's been interesting. He's been pumping Bitcoin as well, but yeah, this idea of like how do you save yourself and how do you save your community, and I think this hunkering down and really in the cross terms, getting into the hole and getting back to basics, like is going to be important. And really focusing on the local.
Yeah, and also I think also like the scientific study where they found that conservatives tend to care most about what's close to them and least about what's really far away, like global warming. And then liberals care very little about what's local and focus almost all their energy on the world and the big picture. Where was I getting with that? Well, I think that possibly the lesson in that is that focusing on ourselves can really go incredibly far. You know, even if you, like, I don't know, that somehow the answers will emerge if you, like, manage to take really good care of your family and think about what your kids needs and those kind of things, that from that, as you work together with more people, like, more and more organizations, structures are going to emerge. I think it can even be a bit dangerous for us to really speculate about, like, oh, well, then we're going to do this and that. And I don't know, because that's been the trap of the liberals, like, you know, the globalist story. We're going to reshape the world, and now we're going to do what do they call it again when you change the climate?
Geoengineer.
Yeah, we're going to block the sun. It's like, dudes, how's your family doing? Yeah. Like Bill Gates, like, how's it going there behind the doors?
Well, that's what it's like, again, whether it's here in the United States, Europe, South Africa, wherever it may, like, that history undulates, or civilization undulates throughout history, and you know, these dark periods. I mean, we've all seen the good times create soft men create hard times create good men, blah, blah, blah. And it seems like we're just at the trough of one of these bad times and trying to climb out. But I think that's the one thing that really upsets me about my generation, the one coming up below me as well, is this idea that starting a family is possible because you don't have the economic ability to provide for it. I think that is one key sort of variable we need to figure out how to reverse.
Right. And
create this optimism.
Yeah.
And I think the money is the core. I mean, that's why we focus on Bitcoin.
Yeah, absolutely. If people can save in Bitcoin, it just, you're like, sure, I can have more kids because my money is going to grow.
Yeah.
I think it's more than just that, but I do agree that it's a significant factor because so many very poor cultures, they have so many kids anyway. Like, they just, you know, so they're not constrained by poverty. I did read this interesting article on natalism, and it was basically saying that if you just look at the kids that survive into adulthoods, who are the kids that can themselves also have kids, that actually the fertility had been pretty constant for centuries. I think they were looking at the Netherlands. It was like 3.2 or something like that. And then you had a decline, interestingly enough, in the 1920s, which was massive money printing, which was the idea that, you know, you can just party and everything is great and everything is just going up. You know, women can just lead their own life. They don't need to be part of a family. They can just kind of become dancers and, you know, whatnot. And then the 30s came, and there was already a recovery in the 30s. And then in the 40s, obviously, because of the war, there was decline. But he said that actually the baby boom was a marriage boom. I thought that was quite profound. And so that it's the long time pairings that is the key to fertility in society. If you have people that get married rather young and they have a long time relationship, then you'll be okay fertility wise. And so that what happened right after the war was just a marriage boom, because if you look at the specific fertility within the marriage, it wasn't even that, people didn't have that many kids, but there were so many marriages. And so I think even more than economically, the challenge is nowadays for young people to find a mate and to get support for the marriage. And I think it's actually one of the side effects probably of this Babylonian confusion that we live in, because you go on a dating app here in Austin.
So many options.
Yeah, well, but maybe because of culture, whatever, I think, I could be wrong, but I think it's rather challenging to actually find someone of your own culture, you know, of that, like, and it doesn't mean that you can never have a long, I'm not married to someone from my own country. So you can definitely bridge that friction, but I think it is, if you have so many people, everyone is having marriages across culturally, it takes years sometimes to get to a place of stability and before you can have kids. So I think that's maybe an under appreciated factor, you know, the lack of cultural homogeneousness in everyday life nowadays.
Yeah. That's a really important one. And the dating, the whole, from what I understand, from the Gen Zers in my life, it's
what are
completely
they
abysmal. Like that, the apps, like you meet somebody, maybe go on a date or two, but again, the optionality that's provided, it's like, oh, maybe there's something better. I'm just going to open the app again. Swipe right a few times and check it out. And sometimes people delaying long-term relationships, I imagine to a degree that has never existed in human history. And then, they're going back to this like Babylonian sort of theme, I think, whether it's the dating side of what many would deem to be degeneracy or hedonism, however you want to describe it. Or I was on a podcast yesterday and I cannot stop after the Trump meme coin thing. I cannot stop thinking of When Money Dies, the particular paragraph where they talk about like the paper boys and the people sweeping the floors in the stock markets. They were all quote unquote getting rich. It seems like the meme coin phenomena is a very similar sort of degenerate, empty wealth that people feel that is manifesting and disseminating right now.
Yeah, like the time preference becomes extremely high. It's all about today or tomorrow.
Yeah.
It is sort of a disease, you know, that's running through society.
It was very unfortunate to see them launch that meme coin.
Oh, yeah.
They didn't even get it. They can't even run a proper meme coin scam. Like,
in their defense, at least they didn't come out and say the U.S. government is partnering with Ripple and we're gonna, you know, that would have been worse. I'd rather have just a plain out scam coin that doesn't pretend to be anything else. At least, you know, it's just a casino thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do think it undermines their kind of moral stature and their reputation. Because as it declines, like, think about all the Trump fans, all the MAGA people who bought this now and who think it's somehow whatever. Like, imagine if you have like 90 IQ and you're like, oh, I got to buy a Trump coin.
I will share some grace. I have had experience with this in this election.
Hmm.
I think they're probably surrounded by just pure grifters who are presenting things in a way that aren't as transparent as maybe they should be. And what you were just describing, like, I had to explain this to RFK's team. They launched like an RFK Solana coin at some point, like when he was still in the race.
Oh.
And, one of the individuals from his team reached out, like, will you post this, like, and help us get some energy around this meme coin? I was like, no, this is a terrible idea. I highly advise against this. And they had no concept. They were like, why advise against this? Like, it's a great way to monetize Bobby's brand. And it's like, well, if he doesn't win the election, like, that meme coin's definitely going to zero. I bet we can look up the price. It's probably not trading very well right now.
Yep.
And you have a bunch of Bobby Kennedy supporters that don't understand the dynamics of this market, and I don't think you guys understand it either, and they're going to buy this coin thinking it's going to accrue in value. If he doesn't win the race, the attention around him and therefore this coin is going to diminish significantly, and you're going to have a bunch of Bobby Kennedy supporters holding fat bags of 99% losses. And these people, they never, like, never occurred to them that this could happen.
Yeah, you're alienating your own base.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, yeah. Did you see that thread? Balaji posted like a long thread on kind of like, oh, well, let's assume, okay, let's just accept that Trump coin is here. Trump coin is here. Well, I forget the details, but one of the things he said was, it's sort of like a lottery. It's sort of, you know, it's a zero-sum game lottery. It's like, well, lottery is different because everybody has an equal chance of winning and there's no advantage for the insiders. Whereas obviously there is one if you launch a coin, massive advantage to the insiders and the people who knew early on, because they're gonna buy a lot and then they'll opportunistically sell out. It's so different. So yeah, not a good move. At least he's kind of rug pulling. Somebody tweeted that it's his way to flex and be like, if you're gonna do this, I'm going to show you who's boss. I'm the biggest. And nobody's going to surpass Trump coin, I don't think.
You don't think?
In the meme world?
No. I mean, for at least maybe not for the next 4 years. But no, it is like I tweeted this out. It's like a signal of, and this is what I said yesterday on this podcast, like the Trump meme coin launch was like a signal of degenerate acceleration. And I think that going back to this cover, excuse me, that could potentially be provided for by this administration. It seems like all bets are off the table. Like, you can just do whatever you want now. Like, I think that was a signal in that launch. It was just like, all right, we're just going to go for it. Degenerate.
Yeah.
Acceleration. Hopefully that also means like Bitcoin innovation can flourish. People can mess around with Chameleon mints and begin implementing them, and we can begin really getting innovative and creative on the privacy and payment side of things, and not have to worry about getting served a Wells notice or having the DOJ come after you for being a money service business, whatever it may be. And it's like, all right, like, I'm interested to get your thoughts. Like, if that is the cost of getting the ability to focus and build out Bitcoin, like, is it worth it compared to
Kamala? Yeah. I think so. I think the Kamala chill factor is crazy. I mean, now we have lawlessness, but in a different way. You know, it's like now scammers are not going to go to jail, whereas under Kamala, honest people are going to go to jail. And that's just awful. But yeah, I have worried about that too, where so anybody can pump and dump now? Like, it's legal to just do pump and dumps? Because the president did it.
Yeah, there are like other...
Also, Ethereum.
Well, that's what I was going
to
say.
They're feeling free all of a sudden to say, oh yeah, it is centralized. We're in charge. Whereas under Gensler, they're always like being weaselly and like, oh no, we're so decentralized.
Yeah, but even like Ethereum's... What are your thoughts on the state of Ethereum right now? I feel like they're...
They're dying.
They're caught.
It's been 10 years.
Yeah, I don't think they're in a good state.
Ethereum delenda est. Ethereum must be destroyed. I mean, it's not that project, but the idea of, you know, a grift where you can have a new narrative every year and a new story to pump your bags, and you keep lying. Like, the lies, they've been lying for 10 years. And the market is showing that the market is sick of it. It's losing against Bitcoin big time. The secular trend has been broken for 1 year now against Bitcoin. It's over. I really think it's over.
Yeah, that's the sort of respectable part of meme coins, is just overt recognition that this is just pure gambling, where Ethereum had this like facade of, we're legitimately going to build a world computer and enable the decentralized future of DeFi and Web 3.0 and...
It's interesting also how they rode that woke wave for 9 years, right? They really, Vitalik is quite brilliant at it, like finding what is it in the zeitgeist that he could like latch on to and be like, oh, but we do that. You know, we're exemplary examples of that. And now the narrative is broken and he knows, like, he's the soy boy. Like, he can't just transform into open source, decentralized, libertarian. Like, he didn't. No, it's over.
No, he explicitly said that in a tweet. He's like, if you think this means we're going to turn into like a BAP-loving, right-wing sort of rah-rah, it's not happening.
It's not happening.
I'm charged.
But it shows that he's aware, right? He's aware of the tension. Yeah.
If I were him, I would just fade.
I think he's probably trying to take
my money and fade into the background.
So many people lost their shirts on Ethereum. I mean, it's not even happened yet. I think it's the biggest damage is still to happen as it keeps declining.
Yeah. Is Steelman here? People are dropping .eth from their X handles. Is that a bottom signal maybe? Yes.
I mean, like, they're barely getting any. Other than Vitalik, nobody's getting engagement who's tweeting about Ethereum. I just think it's dead. The only thing is that there's apparently a lot of startups that have built their technology to fit exactly on the Ethereum virtual machine. But it seems that the whole machine could be ported to Bitcoin. And so, you know, the guys at SpiderChain are working on that. And Maybe we even want that machine, though.
Like, that's another. I'm very convicted in the idea that the whole DeFi meme is just a siren call. The actual signal is the Bitcoinization of finance, where you have, like we were describing, a massive debt problem, both on the public and private side of the market globally. And you essentially need to restructure the financial system with better collateral. And instead of creating these obscure, complex DeFi systems with bridges and different tokens and treasury management systems and DAOs and liquidity pools, whatever it may be, it's like just go left side of the bell curve, complete caveman, like, oh, no, maybe we just need to send Bitcoin the other way into the financial system and help recapitalize a woefully systemically fragile credit system.
But Marty, Zeppelins could change the world. And we have so many Zeppelin engineers already. Like, what are you talking about? It's not because one of them burns down that we got to stop doing it.
Yeah. But I mean, at 1031, we have a lot of these conversations with potential investors, and a lot of that class is still stuck on this, like, DeFi.
Yeah.
Web 3.0. Yeah. It's like, I think it's a siren call.
It's also like, cart before the horse. Is like, well, you need something solid. You need bedrock before you can build on it. It's like, oh yeah, but we have this amazing structure. And you're like, okay, where did you build it? It's like, oh yeah, out there in the swamp. It's like, all right, well, it's going to sink eventually, unless you do like Venice and you figure out how to build in the swamp. But I don't think Ethereum has done that at all.
No.
They've hard forked 17 times. Like, that is, to me, that's enough.
Yeah.
To be like, it's a non-starter.
Yeah.
17 hard forks.
What are your thoughts on the state of the Bitcoin market right now? We're
105.
105 or below. This is like the lowest.
Mm.
This is the worst post-halving performance that Bitcoin's had, believe it or not, since it launched.
Yeah, my feeling is that it's because people have felt that global markets are overheated. Investors are a bit wary about global markets. Interest rates are going up. These government bonds are, you know, really starting to fade. And if you look at commodity charts as well, they're kind of undecided. Like, are we going to go higher or are we going to really have a big pullback? And so I feel that's what's holding investors back mainly. So if we had a big crash, then they could be like, all right, now we have a bottom in Bitcoin, like kablam, like then we'd go up hard. But yeah, I do think I still think it's going to be an incredible bull market. I really, really think so. Because there is so much lawlessness and uncertainty and decay, and it's like, and then you appreciate even more the thing that always every 10 minutes, new block that is so reliable, that is absolutely scarce. So yeah, I really think it's going to be a big rally. But I think people want to know, like, are we going to hypercharge inflation in this, you know, the next 4 years? Is Trump going to print like crazy? Or is there going to be some kind of crash and then we'll deal with that?
Have you been following the remarks of Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent? Or I don't think
he's officially confirmed. What does he say?
I mean, I've done a couple episodes with people who've been studying his public remarks over the last 12 to 18 months. And you know his history.
Not really.
He helped Soros do the British pound trade. So he helped speculative attack the pound. Okay. He did a big yen trade during the Asian crisis. And the consensus of people who have been studying his work over the course of his career and his comments more recently is that if you are looking for to thread a needle on the level of global monetary reset, like, he's the man for the job. Like, he understands debt markets and currency markets better than most. And he has publicly stated within the last year that he thinks we need like a Bretton Woods 2.0, like monetary reset.
What would that look like?
I don't know. Like, maybe like a coming to the table, like, look, this global debt situation's out of control.
Haircuts,
jubilees, whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
And a resetting, and maybe. I don't think he's as up the curve on the Bitcoin thesis, and particularly as a reserve asset, as many of us would like him to be. But I think if the right people got in his ear, potentially be like, all right, we're going to have to remonetize some of the system with this neutral reserve asset that exists.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that seems good for Bitcoin if that's part of the story. I think Europe is toast. So the euro is still a pretty big currency. So it'd be interesting to see if that one gets a big knockdown.
It has to. It's done. Mm-hmm. And it was foretold when Eurozone, European Union, and the euro launched.
Yeah, but now it's starting to get very real, because if, you know, AFD, of course, in poly market, the betting markets, they're not really getting a lot of chance to win. But if Germany were to pull out, for example, you know, that's just... So I feel Europe is going to break up somehow. That means the euro... I mean, probably the dollar would get stronger temporarily.
Do you think the consensus among the citizens of Europe is that a breakup's necessary, or do you think most want to keep together?
People are probably afraid, but also once you heard enough...
This
once
is only like a 30-40-year experience or experiment, right?
Yeah, it's very young. I remember in elementary school, they were talking about, oh, the euro gets introduced, and it was Belgium. Like, I was at the heart of it, you know, and so it's very young. Maybe, yeah, of course, the young people don't remember, but... No, the euro, the eurozone, the EU. So I think that would also obviously be good for Bitcoin, because it's kind of showing the inherent fragility and failure of the fiat system. It's different than, like, I don't know, the Turkish lira doing badly, if it's really Europe.
Yeah.
But yeah, short term, it's hard. It's hard to kind of know what's going on. I do think the US is going to probably pull through because of the Doge. You know, if they cut a lot of spending, that would really make businesses very excited.
If they cut spending, and I mean, partly confirmed, part rumor, but I mean, Trump announced it on day one about this external revenue service. Obviously, tariffs have been a big part of his platform leading up to him coming into office. But the rumor from somewhat credible sources has been he's like literally thinking about eliminating federal income tax.
That would be amazing.
if you're,
does that mean eliminating all the IRS or not? Is there more to the IRS than that?
I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, it's in that direction.
It would be incredible.
Yeah, that's how cities used to operate, right? And you wouldn't really tax what's going on inside. You would just levy a toll on what comes in and goes out.
Yeah.
And that encourages local entrepreneurs to just add a lot of value.
Think about the windfall of cash that would have for American citizens.
Yeah. Very nice. Yeah, but it's still a presidential system, right? So I don't know how long the Republicans can kind of stay in control. Is it going to be 8 years? Yeah, maybe Vance could win the next one.
Yeah, I guess it's too early to tell.
Yeah.
Until day three, maybe.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, I think Bitcoin is just... It'll be weird, though, to talk back next time and be like, oh, it's 300,000. What do you think? Like, what? But yeah, I think we'll see 400 probably this cycle.
I think so.
Yeah. What do you think?
I think we go higher than that.
Yeah. I think likely.
I guess it's highly dependent on the global macro situation. Do we go into a depression? Maybe harder for Bitcoin to get that high. If not, all systems go. Turn the money printer back on. Who knows? That's the other thing. Just looking at, going back to what we were discussing when we started this part of the conversation, like, can they actually fix it with Doge and all this stuff? I think it is inarguably a net positive, but you look at the liquidity boogeymen that are sitting behind the scenes. Like, you look at commercial mortgage-backed security, mm-hmm, and the delinquency rates of the underlying commercial real estate mortgages, they're up at like 2009 levels, like, wow, 11%.
That's the other one, right? The real estate market.
I mean, look at Austin. You know, all these cranes in the sky, and I know, like, the Facebook building that they were building, like, Facebook pulled out of that. Like, how much inventory is coming online? How much of that's actually going to be filled here?
Yep.
How much of that debt was taken out in the last 2 years?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think prices are down residential 15% or something from the peak.
I saw 25 earlier this year. Yeah.
Whoa, 25 from the peak?
Yeah.
Wow.
Do you have something to say, Logan? Logan's breathing deeply over there. Think hard about Austin real estate prices. Yeah, I guess we'll find out.
Paradigm shifts. Absolutely. The idea of a house being a store of value, I think that's, at least it will still be, but not in the places that we're used to looking, like, you know, LA, New York.
That's, could be a black swan. You have $180 billion of insurance claims that are about to flood. The people that insured those houses in LA, like, is that a...
That's
black swan systemic risk. Yeah. Like, do they have liquidity? Yeah. Are they going to need a bailout? Could that be the catalyst for the next big print? Who knows?
Yeah, I do have a hard time seeing Trump as the big austere president. I just feel like he likes to kind of be Santa Claus. You know, he likes to give people what they want. And he's been a real estate guy. So he kind of, you know, he's born and raised in cheap money. So I think higher inflation is really coming. The second wave. Like, we had that first big wave after COVID.
It's already beginning to rear its head again.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've been stunned that gas has been so cheap for so long. I keep saying, like, this is the last time we'll see it below three, and then it keeps dipping.
And we're like $2.50 a gallon right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll take that.
Yep.
All right. Are we optimistic or pessimistic? Combination of both.
I think it's incredibly special to be alive today, because yes, bad things are happening, but also amazing things are happening at the same time. And doesn't happen very often that so much change happens at the same time and you get to choose which story you're part of. So I'm very glad to be alive now.
Yeah. Choose the optimistic timeline. Mm. Adopt Bitcoin. Peace and love, freaks.